Hey, everybody, and welcome to episode 2 of the Neil Before Zod podcast. My name is Lee Klontz, and with me is Adam Levine.
Hey, Lee, how you doing?
I'm doing well, Adam. Tonight, we're going to talk about Star Wars versus Star Trek, two of our favorite franchises going back for decades. They've both seen a resurgence in the past few years, led by J.J. Abrams. That's going to be one of the topics we talk about. We'll look at some new trailers for Rogue One and for Star Trek Beyond, and then we'll go into a lightning round of questions.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. And a reminder to our listeners that you can find our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud, and follow us on Twitter at Zod Podcast.
Great, let's get started.
All right.
All right, and we're going to get started with the big question. And obviously, it's hard to look at the world of sci-fi without seeing the impact that J.J. Abrams has had over the past couple of years. He first rebooted the Star Trek universe a couple of years back, and of course with a sequel that met with some mixed reviews. And then last year, took the reins with Star Wars and created The Force Awakens, of course, which was a hugely successful film. Adam, let's start talking about which he did the best with and what worked and what didn't.
Well, one thing I think it may be worthwhile getting out of the way first, just to let our audience kind of know where we're both coming from. If I were to ask you the question, if you were stranded on a desert island and you could only take one of these IPs with you, which one would it be for you?
You know, I grew up watching both, but Star Trek hit my age group at a bit of a weird time. The original TV series kind of peaked and went away before I was born. And then Star Trek The Motion Picture came out when I was a young kid. So I didn't kind of grow up watching the original series all that much. I grew up really with the movies. I was really into the movies, never as much into the show. I was aware of it, but it's a long way of saying that Star Wars kind of hit me right in my wheelhouse when I was 4 years old, and that was really the story of my growing up. Star Trek, I saw all the movies. I watched the shows periodically. I liked Next Generation, but it was never really central to my being in the way that Star Wars was. How about you?
That totally makes sense. And that's obviously, I knew that, but I thought I would let our loving audience know. For me, it's a little bit different. I'm a couple of years older than you, and I actually grew up watching Kirk and the original crew. And I think that was the first thing I saw. I saw it well before I ever saw any Star Wars. And I think I bonded to that at a very early age. Like watching that show on TV it was so exciting for me. You know, because a lot of the TV of that era that I was watching was like garbage. But then suddenly I was getting to see Star Trek and it was color. And I was like, oh, my God, this is awesome. And, you know, we'll get in, of course, to the movies and the rich history there. And that's not to say I don't love Star Wars and I don't have a very deep bond to that as well. I absolutely do. I love both these properties to death. But no doubt for me, Star Trek over Star Wars. It's close, but it's pretty clear to me which one's better.
And see, for me, I have a great deal of respect for Star Trek and where it pioneered, and for all of the franchises and frankly the special effects technology and the storytelling that it really brought into the fold. To say nothing of the social aspects, which are huge. I have huge respect for that, but they're not in my core the way that Star Wars is. So,
right. Okay, so let's get back though to the fact that we've got a perfect storm. We may never see this again, where one guy directs essentially the reboot movie for two monster franchises. I mean, we probably will see it, the way Hollywood is all about sequels, and someday somebody will be doing James Bond and Star Wars and Star Trek and, you know, and Captain America. It'll be like that someday, some insane, never-ending mill of sequels that we're into. But we do have this interesting situation where the same guy directed both films. Just for some quick context, I looked it up. Star Trek 2009, its Rotten Tomatoes score was 95. Users gave it a 91. Metacritic gave it an 82. Force Awakens 2015, Rotten Tomatoes 92, users 89, Metacritic 81. So in terms of those metrics, which, you know, you can take with a grain of salt, you know, The Force Awakens is ranked slightly below Star Trek.
Would you support that rating for the Star Trek reboot?
I would. You know, I recently rewatched both of them, and obviously I've had way more opportunities to watch Star Trek, which I think was a really successful reboot. You know, obviously, so you have JJ who did both films, but in this case, for Star Trek, he was literally going back and using the core characters. So he wasn't advancing an existing story as he does in Force Awakens. So granted, there's some apples and oranges there. But I think as a film, it's more successful because it's not straying into the world of, like, I have to worry about creating new characters and advancing a mythology or trying to reconnect, you know, to Star Wars fans in a different way than was needed for Star Trek, which just needed a reboot after, you know, it had gone through the progression of some successful films and a lot of really bad films, and it went from the original cast to the Picard and the Next Generation cast. It was a different beast. Star Wars, clearly, you know, Disney went out and spent a lot of money on that, wrestling that IP away from Lucas, who, $4 billion or whatever he got, he probably got a bad deal on that. They're probably laughing on that number at this point. But at the end of the day, I think Force Awakens, in rewatching it, it just has a lot of big time problems that I think Star Trek isn't problem free, but they don't impede the story in the same way.
Well, you know, I think you're right. I would disagree, I think, in terms of, I do think Force Awakens was a more successful reboot, but I think one thing that JJ did with both JJ, like, I know the guy, like, we're buddies, but what JJ did that, really can't be overlooked is he took two franchises that in the eyes of the true fans were kind of on the ropes. I mean, the last great Star Trek movie was maybe First Contact. I mean, but First Contact is pretty corny even when you go back to view it. But when you think about great Star Trek movies, that's generally the last Star Trek movie that anyone really liked. Nemesis was terrible.
Wait a second. Nemesis was terrible? The movie that brought us Tom Hardy playing a young Picard? Are you saying that wasn't a good plot line?
Maybe we need to revisit that one. That was about the dregs. That was the depths. And it really, I mean, you know, he took, you know, Star Trek, which people had, you know, as a film franchise had kind of seen its day. And Star Wars, as much as the prequels made, you know, a lot of money, the true fans were kind of a little burnout on that franchise as well. I think it's really to his credit that he was able to make both of them into rejuvenated and successful franchises.
Definitely. What are some of the moments that really work for you in Force Awakens, and what are the ones that just don't work for you? Like what would you change in Force Awakens to make it a better story or a better experience?
I think that the tone is sometimes a bit off. It's kind of funny looking back at the original Star Wars films and then looking at the prequels. I think the biggest problem with the prequels is they have a really kind of an odd tone. And I think it's less about the prequels and more about the fact that the original trilogy had such a special vibe. I mean, there was something really compelling about the pacing. I mean, the pacing of Star Wars is very slow. When you go back to look at the original Star Wars, it is not a movie that moves in a modern way. It's a very slow, very deliberate movie. I was actually I don't know why I was doing this, but I had a file of Episode 4 pulled up the other day, and I was scrubbing through, and the halfway point of that movie is when they're on the Death Star. And it's kind of interesting to think back that, like, I tend to think of the Death Star scene as being very kind of close to the end, but there's actually, that's a very, it's a movie that is not paced in a way that is current with what you would see in a typical blockbuster today. And I don't think it's just because it was the 70s. I think it was they just had a really novel kind of pacing to that trilogy, and the prequels really failed to recapture that. I could see JJ trying to do the same thing with The Force Awakens, but I still think the tone is a little odd. You know, you've got this huge coincidence that Finn just happens to kind of walk into this city on Jakku. I that really bothered me when I watched the movie again, that he crash lands, you know, at random, goes to the TIE fighter where Poe's jacket is off for some reason, basically so he can get it, and then happens to walk in the one direction where there's a settlement, where Rey happens to be, and where the Millennium Falcon just happens to be sitting there waiting to take off. The coincidences kind of bothered me in retrospect. In fact, that's the one thing as I look back at that movie, bothers me the most. That, and of course the fact that, you know, the whole conceit of the movie is very much an almost one for one replication of Episode 4.
Yeah. Well, let's come back to that in a second, the whole Starkiller, you know, hidden plans angle, because I think that bears a little bit of a deeper dig. But I found when I rewatched the movie, I will say this, the first time I saw it, I think, and from the trailers, there was sort of an impression that this was going to be the Finn story. And I think when, you know, you watch it and you realize this is actually Rey's story. You know, Finn's just kind of a character who, like, comes in and out and advances the story. But it's about her. It's really all about her, in my mind. Mm-hmm. That story is, you know, or The Force Awakens. It's awakening in her. She has the weird, weird, weird episode with the lightsaber when she goes into, like, the sub-basement. I didn't like how they handle it. I like the content in the scene. It was cool to see her vision. But they tried to do, like, the whatever the Force Cave was from Dagobah. Yep. And I was like, what the hell? That was a horribly executed scene that could have been done so many different ways, you'd think. But, you know, I think, yeah, I'm with you. I don't really actually like any of the interplay. Like, Finn and Rey, when they are interacting, I find this is really weird. You know, because they're teasing in the movie, like, he's into her. And, you know, she's more about, like, the moral value of getting it done and, you know, let's do the right thing. I don't know. There's something weird about that whole dynamic that I don't like and doesn't work for me at all.
Well, and the Maz Kanata character, who my understanding is was originally a bigger part of the story. I'm glad she wasn't, and I could have used less of her. She really felt like, you know, Basil exposition, just kind of there to move the story forward. You know, looking back, it's not even really clear to me why they even went to her cantina, except to have a cantina scene.
It actually doesn't make sense at all. I was having just recently watched that. That's kind of one of the plot points you drill on, and you're like, wait a second. Because there's this whole thing where Finn, he's like, you know, he's playing this I'm part of the rebellion thing because he thinks it's, like, cool for Rey, you know, because he's trying to flirt with her. And that gets carried past them going to the cantina where she still doesn't know he's full of shit. And at the end of the day, it's like Han just kind of steps in and like, oh, well, if we want to find the rebellion, let's go to the cantina. But if Finn was legit, it would have been like Wise and Finn doing something, or BB-8 must know where they are. It's like it's like contrived and meaningless for them to be there.
Well, and, you know, to back up, you know, 15 minutes earlier in the movie, the fact that Han finds them so quickly is kind of ridiculous too. When you watch the movie, literally they're in the air off of Jakku for about maybe 4 minutes. They have their little kind of problem with the Falcon, and then suddenly Han's there with that horrible scene with the Rathtars and that whole CG thing. That was J.J. Abrams kind of doing that J.J. Abrams thing that he can't seem to help but do. That whole scene doesn't work at all.
Yeah, those creatures are like a horrible cross between, like, if you did like the Sarlacc pit monster and mashed it up with like the Ghostbusters dude with the teeth,
yes,
whatever his name is. Like, that's what those look like. Yeah. That's a definite JJ moment where you're like, dude, didn't need to happen. Like, and he does that in Star Trek too, where when Kirk goes down to the planet where Scotty is and he gets, like, you know, attacked by that crazy creature. It was, you know, it was okay, but this is totally unnecessary. And that's kind of one of those ones where someone's like, insert another action sequence here, or we've got this really cool special effect. Let's make sure we use it here so there's not too much talking.
Yeah, that scene. Well, when we talk about Star Trek, that is definitely a scene that I think is the low point of that movie. But yeah, I mean, I thought that The Force Awakens kind of had these points it wanted to hit. And this is, again, this is Abrams. This is, you know, this is Lost. This is Mission Impossible 3. When he wants to get from point A to point B and the plot isn't going to take him there, he'll just kind of fuzz the line. He'll just kind of fudge it. And then just kind of try to make you forget that what just happened didn't really make any sense at all. So, yeah, I thought the whole Takadana scene really could have been dropped. It made no sense the way she found the lightsaber, why it was there. When they ask about it, it's just like, it's a good question for another time. It's like, no, that's a question that really could be answered right now. And, you know, I hope that will pay off, but it feels kind of like lazy filmmaking.
Well, the bad news there is they're going to have to pay that off. You know, in the movie, she's like, well, that's a story for another day as to why I have Luke's lightsaber. Like, they're going to have to tell that story now, right? Because they wrote it that way. And it's like, talk about, I don't want to hear that story. Because right. No matter what it is, it's going to be stupid.
Right. A lightsaber last seen falling down a pit in Cloud City on a disembodied hand. I mean, there's no excuse for that to show up anywhere ever again.
Or even if they're going to spin it and say it's like he rebuilt one when he opened up the Luke Skywalker Jedi Academy, you know, which obviously didn't work out too well for him. And like, even if that's like somehow that lightsaber, you know, that the instructor's lightsaber, because obviously you don't open up a Force Academy without your own lightsaber. So whatever it is, it's going to be bad.
Yeah, there's really no redeeming that scene. That was really poor. And I think as a character, she really seems to only exist to kind of put some glue together. And I think that's going to be, I think they're going to have to really write their way out of that. What, you know, one other critique I've heard of the movie that I do also, I see the problem with is that in a lot of ways it invalidates the entirety of Return of the Jedi. You know, Return of the Jedi was about the Empire being defeated and things being great. And it kind of feels like at the beginning of Episode 7 that things are just as crappy as they were at the beginning of Episode 4. That, you know, yeah. It's the exact same situation. It's like, well, what was all that about? It was supposed to be a great victory, but not so much.
It's like the only plausible narrative for the emergence of the First Order and yet another, you know, evil, you know, Sith or whatever we're going to find out that the Supreme Leader is that the Rebellion, while successful as a Rebellion, then installed incompetent leadership that allowed this thing to just repeat and rinse on them. Like in less than like 2 decades, they're facing the same problem again because they don't know what they're doing.
Yeah, I think it might have been a better tactic to have the Republic be this robust government and have the New Order be this kind of quiet underground effort instead of this gigantic army capable of building a laser into a planet. I think it might have been kind of interesting to see, you know, to see almost the New Order as a rebellion against the what was the rebellion, the current government, instead of this
massive army evil corporation that's all ready to go.
It's like Leia is on the ropes from like the first time you see her, and it's like, well, when was she ever, did she ever kind of have a moment where things weren't awful? Apparently not.
Okay, so let's come back to the core premise of the film, which everyone's trying to find out where Luke is. Which, why is there a hidden plan to where Luke is? So who created that? Either Luke did or someone who knows where Luke was going did. And then if he did, he's an idiot. If it's someone else, then that someone else went and hid the pieces. Who is this person hiding that intel from? Like, what was the grand plan for anything to ever come back to Luke, if that's a plan at all? And if it's not, who created these tapes? It just, there's no good story there.
Well, and what's funny is the map that BB-8 had ended up being not even useful anyway, because they needed R2 to wake up, which it's kind of
right,
kind of narratively screwy that he was like just sleeping for years, and then wakes up when BB-8 decides to bust the map out. That the whole map sequence, I don't know. I think that was also just, it was lazy. And that's, you know, if I have anything about J.J. Abrams that kills me, it's just that he seems to be capable of making about 80% of a really cool, really interesting story. But, you know, he did it with, I mean, Lost is the most kind of critical example. You know, he set up all this really cool stuff, but he couldn't close the deal, you know, and at the end, it's just kind of like, eh, and he just kind of like waves his hands and hopes you don't mind. And with Star Wars, I think he made it work, but it needed another rewrite, I think.
Yeah. Okay. And obviously we talked briefly about it. The Starkiller base, essentially, that, you know, they split the thing. This time the secret plans were to find where Luke is, and then we still have to blow up the Death Star, aka Starkiller. It just, nothing about that as a weapon or that as a plan from the First Order's perspective makes a lick of sense.
No. So you have a star-powered planet gun that once it consumes its star, I don't know really what it does then. Does it move? There's no sign that it has any kind of engines. Is it kind of a one-shot deal? Because they fire it twice. But then once its star is depleted, everything goes dark. Now, it's kind of interesting. In the novelization of The Force Awakens, Alan Dean Foster wrote it. It's terrible. I don't recommend it. But it's kind of interesting because instead of absorbing the matter from the neighboring star, it actually absorbs, you know, the hypothetical dark matter from, you know, from space. And so it's absorbing dark matter and leaving the star intact. So the narrative is a little bit different. I don't know if it was because dark matter is kind of an esoteric thing for it to be absorbing, or if, as I kind of suspect, that Abrams liked that kind of, you know, as things got darker on the planet, you know, the situation was growing more grim. And so as Han dies, spoiler alert, you know, everything finally goes dark for the last time. I suspect it was kind of for the visual, which is cool. It actually, you know, works really well. But you have this problem that you have this energy, this planet gun thing powered by an energy source that now it's exhausted at the end of the movie. So I don't know. Again, it feels really, really kind of lazy to me.
Yeah, it wasn't super clear to me, frankly, where they were going to fire that second time. Like, I know they target in that first cluster of whatever, five or six shots of the planets in the same system. I think they're basically, like, trying to wipe out the rest of the old Republic? Or the Senate? I don't know.
The Senate, yeah.
Like, whatever they take out there, obviously they destroy it. But what was their next target going to be?
I think it was going to be where...
Was it
going to
be the Rebel base?
Yeah, I think so.
Which they have ascertained the location of from when? Like, I just wasn't clear about that. They make it seem like, yeah, sure, that makes sense. Let's blow them up. Which, of course, is a horrible, you know, reshred of Star Wars, but they don't actually establish that clearly in the movie.
You're not wrong. I don't recall, actually.
Okay. Let me ask you another question.
Okay.
Kylo Ren. Now, I know they're setting him up because he's got this emotional arc, blah, blah, blah. I didn't think he really matched. Like, Kylo Ren at this point is the number two to the Supreme Leader, right? There's always a master and an apprentice, right? So he's the apprentice to this guy. And that's fine. But every other person who's held that post, by the time they actually were good enough to be number two, they weren't like a tiny, you know, explosion ready for a temper tantrum at any moment, which he literally has a temper tantrum when he learns that they escaped from Jakku. And he's like overly immature. And I was like kind of comparing in my head to like, that just wouldn't fly. Darth Maul, Darth Vader, none of those guys would be like acting like a fool like he is.
No, you're right. I mean, it's kind of interesting because, you know, not too many of the Sith characters from the original trilogy or the prequel trilogy actually really got to spend much time as a character. I mean, you know, Darth Vader as a young person is kind of a whiny brat like Kylo Ren. But then, like, you know, Maul has no personality. Dooku has, you know, just a minimal personality, a very kind of plot necessary personality, but no real motivation that we ever see. I do kind of like about Kylo Ren that he is kind of, you know, he is Darth Vader in reverse. You know, he feels the pull to the light side. I thought that was actually kind of a neat twist, and that he needed something to push him over to the dark side, whereas, you know, Anakin was always kind of the opposite. You know, he was like, you know, he was basically good, and there was good in him his whole life, but he was pulled by these emotional forces to be dark. I don't know if that's going to pay off. I hope it doesn't pay off with Kylo Ren turning into a good guy eventually, because that only works if he stays bad. But yeah, the personality, the temper tantrum thing, it's kind of funny, but I don't know that it's such a great scene for a Star Wars movie.
I really didn't like that scene. I definitely would have cut that out.
It would have been a great, you know, Blu-ray extra.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. Kylo Ren temper tantrum, take two. One of the criticisms I recall was around the Rey character, which, you know, I think that's, you know, that makes sense that that character would be criticized as the focal point of the movie. A lot of people were saying she's too good at everything. You know, that was like one of the criticisms I saw in several places. And that actually that doesn't bother me, because whatever, you know, we'll hear the ultimate truth. The theory I like the most is that she's a Kenobi. And if she is, that kind of makes sense, because historically, if your name is Kenobi, you're a badass. You know, in the Jedi power rankings, Kenobi is above every Skywalker. Pretty much every time those guys go head to head, Kenobi comes out on top.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're right.
So that makes sense to me that she's a Kenobi and she's a badass, and she's ultimately going to be the one who takes down Skywalker grandchild number one. So we'll see where that goes, but I was actually okay with that.
Well, you know, I think one of the things that we haven't seen before is kind of non-Jedi or Sith wielding lightsabers. That's always been something that, you know, has been kind of treated like this kind of elevated thing to be able to do, you know. But for, you know, Finn is trained in hand-to-hand combat, and so for him it's just a sword, you know. You gotta be careful, you can lop your arm off. But and I think for Rey it's the same thing. You know, you see her, she fights with her stick, so when she has to fight with a sword like weapon, it's not totally out of bounds that she would be competent with it. You know, by that point Kylo Ren has his side shot open by the bowcaster, so it didn't bother me either. I thought that you know, the times she used the Force, it was almost like she was discovering it, and it was kind of on accident, and she was, you know, it was more kind of an awakening of something latent inside of her, as opposed to her being able to kind of be in very good command of it.
Yeah, no, completely.
I'll tell you my biggest narrative beef, I think, though, looking back, and this is, I don't know, maybe this is just my own personal thing. So they have this scene, they set up what they have to do to destroy Starkiller Base. They've got, you know, the power regulator or whatever. It's, of course, just some exposed thing. And so you had a similar scene in Return of the Jedi. They had this whole elaborate scheme cooked up to drop the shield. You know, they've got a stolen shuttle, and they're going to go, and they're going to have the codes, and you've got that, you know, that fun scene where they fly by and they land, and then they, you know, have this kind of whole guerrilla sequence. The answer to how they get through what is presumably even better improved shield technology is, we just hyperspace through it. That was such a lazy storytelling moment for me, because I was really kind of excited. I'm like, okay, how are they going to do this now? That was such a kind of a great part of Return of the Jedi as to kind of how they're going to get access to the Death Star 2. Starkiller Base, they literally just kind of like fly in. And, you know, I really felt like that's another case where they really could have put, you know, a couple of hours of thought into maybe a little more interesting way to get past that.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. And it actually kind of reminds me of a similar moment in Star Trek, you know, which we probably should talk more about, where they beam across the galaxy, you know, and which is just horrible, a horrible just assault on canon,
the worst.
And just breaking all the rules. And they, you know, unfortunately, they go on to double down into that territory in Into Darkness, where, again, Khan transports into, like, beyond the neutral zone into Klingon space. But that's a movie for another day to discuss. But, yeah, it's the same thing. It's they're like, oh, let's kind of say this is like a thing, you know, where there, you can warp in and, but we'll cheat it and say, you don't have to worry whether there's a planet in front of you when you do it, or we're going to say transportation, you know, we'll be fast and loose with that. I mean, as if that wouldn't completely change the outcome of technology and exploration in space if you could do that.
Well, it's such an affront in two ways, really, right? It's the distance, and it's at freaking warp speed. Like when they do it, it's like that whole sequence, I think, almost killed that movie for me, where, you know, Spock gets so mad at Kirk, he ejects him onto a snow planet, which I don't think a reasonable Starfleet officer would do that. They have a brig, right? They could put him somewhere. I don't think they would eject him out the hatch onto a planet they just have to be going by. And then he gets out and gets chased by some kind of critter to Scotty, who has an experimental warp technology that can warp you not only onto that can transport you not only into a warping spaceship across the galaxy, but like they warp him into like a pipe. You know, remember that, the whole, that terrible sequence where Scotty's stuck in the pipe? It's just awful. It's a terrible moment. It's like, God, like, I don't think J.J. Abrams has ever seen a Star Trek movie before or a Star Trek episode.
Yeah, I mean, that's 100% one of the core tenets of Star Trek is it's more grounded in science. It definitely takes crazy liberties, but that sort of like, we're going to change that rule up that's already been established was, yeah.
Well, and if you remember, I'm sure you've seen Star Trek the Motion Picture as many times as I have, like that, which takes place in roughly the same time frame, since it's a, you know, it's kind of a time flip, time reboot. In like the first 20 minutes of the movie, people get like killed because they can't beam them from like Earth up right. to the Enterprise without turning them into jello, you know? And somehow it's like, yeah, whatever. We got to get Kirk back on the ship. How the hell are we going to do that? Just beam him. It's the same problem. It's the same kind of just lazy, like, smudge the line storytelling just to kind of move the story forward. It's the sign of a, you know, a writer and a director that's kind of written himself into a hole and then just takes a lazy way out, an easy way out.
Yeah, no, I'm with you, because otherwise, like, and this is something I would also say for Force Awakens. I love the first third of this film, you know, the sort of origin story, which we'd never seen before, you know, the Grand Theft Auto Kirk and Fight Club Spock, and you get to kind of see where they're coming from. Mm-hmm. And we get the Kobayashi Maru origin story, which is a wonderful callback to, you know, Wrath of Khan. And you sort of have this new take on Kirk. And I really like it, but yeah, it gets bogged down. There's the problem we talked about with the whole transportation thing that really screws the story. And I think the big other sort of sinker for the film is the villain, and the story there is just kind of, who cares? Like, I love Eric Bana as an actor, but man, he looked, you know, he didn't look like a Romulan. He didn't look like he was given enough to play with, and it just didn't work. It was just like, oh, okay, so he's mad at Spock, and he's got, like, this elaborate plan to get back at him, which, you know, involves some, you know, planet drilling and red matter.
Yeah. And Spock, old Spock and young Spock. You know, it really makes me wonder, I mean, when you watch that movie, I mean, I think the most successful part of the Star Trek reboot is that first, like, 10 or 15 minutes with Kirk's father. I think I would have rather seen a movie that focused maybe on the Kelvin instead of the Enterprise and this whole kind of different crew as a precursor rather than this like time flip thing, which I don't think makes a lot of sense, because then you've got the problem of, you know, circumstances being radically different, but the entire crew happening to still all meet up and still being on the same ship and a lot of things still happening, even though the past has effectively been reset. I think it might have been more interesting. Like, I think the Kelvin and that whole sequence is a much more interesting sequence than anything that comes after.
I mean, I definitely love that sequence, but in terms of how that Star Trek property has been handled since its inception. If someone had pitched that, they would have just made it a TV show. You know, it would have been whatever, Star Trek Origins, the history of the Kelvin, or the history of, you know, however they wanted to get into setting up Star Trek.
No, you're right. You do need the Kirk, Spock, Uhura, triumvirate. You're right.
The reboot actually didn't bother me. Like, I was able to accept that. Like, that concept, you know, it's okay. It's believable enough. It's a show that has talked about traveling in time before, so that wasn't, you know, some new concept. And it's a show that had talked about what happens if you manipulate time, that it also, that was already part of the canon as well. That didn't actually bother me. I thought they handled that maybe not the best way, but I thought it wasn't as riddled with bullets as other parts of the movie.
Yeah, I just, you know, it's kind of like what's happening now with the X-Men movies, though, is it's like now all of the stuff that we, all of the movies and the shows that we grew up with have been effectively wiped off the map, right? I mean, they didn't exist, or they existed in an alternate timeline, or however you want to say. And I don't know that that was really necessary. I would almost rather they just, fine, they start clean slate, you know, we'll never replace Leonard Nimoy and William Shatner. So we're just going to reboot the universe, but we're going to do it with a new cast, and we're going to do it kind of without trying to tie it in with the old, you know. I think that's really going to hold them back as they move forward, because, you know, we're already seeing, and maybe the new movie will be different, but, you know, Star Trek Into Darkness was kind of a rehash of Wrath of Khan, but not as good. I hope they don't feel like they've got to keep doing that, because I think that will really hold back what they could do with this new crew. I like the new crew. It's a great cast.
Yeah, no, that's definitely the strongest point. That crew is great, and we'll see how long they end up keeping them together, but, you know, that's probably going to have a lot to do with how Star Trek Beyond does, which we will be talking about coming up. All right, let's move on to our trailer talk section, which, in our Star Trek versus Star Wars themed episode, we're going to look at Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, which is coming out in December. And we're also going to talk about the Star Trek Beyond trailer, which is coming out July 22nd. So let's talk about Rogue One, A Star Wars Story first. Here's a little taste of it.
We have a mission for you. A major weapons test is imminent. We need to know what it is and how to destroy it.
Is that clear?
Yes, sir.
Okay, Lee, so you've seen this. It just recently came out that the Disney executives were getting feedback that this movie wasn't on tone. I think the tone of the trailer I actually like. I think it looks like kind of a serious, you know, possibly old school movie about, like, let's go on a secret mission and, you know, let's recruit the band of misfits or whatever it's going to be there. I like the cast. I like Felicity Jones, Ben Mendelsohn, I love as the villain, and Alan Tudyk and Donnie Yen, who I've, you know, always loved in some of the action movies he's done. You got Forrest Whitaker. But, you know, obviously there's some pushback on the tone. What's your take on that? Do you think someone's looking at this and saying it's too serious or it's a bummer ending? What do you think we're looking at here?
Well, I mean, you know, any major Hollywood movie has reshoots. I mean, that's not a surprise. That's not anything that people should, I think, assume too much about. You know, most movies are made or lost in the editing room. So the fact that this isn't done, it's okay. It's only June. They've got 6 months to finish it. And, I think if they are going for what appears to be a significantly more serious tone, you know, episode 7 was, for the most part, pretty light, as were the original films. I think that it's probably, I mean, look, nobody's going to write off a Star Wars film, especially coming off of episode 7. This movie is going to make a lot of money, and it's going to be probably very successful, but this is a movie which appears to have, as far as we know, almost no characters that we are familiar with, so it doesn't have a lot of nostalgia to fall back on, except for the kind of the kind of locations and costumes that we remember from episode four. But it does, it's I think it is kind of a, again, I think to call anything Star Wars a long shot is probably overstating it. But this is it's a bold move to go with something that looks more adult than episode seven.
Does it bother you that this movie is again being trapped by a known outcome, right? At the end of the day, we don't know as much, right? But we know they're going to succeed. They're going to get those plans because they have to, because that leads to, you know, the entire story behind episode four. So we know they're going to be successful. Some will live, some will die, whatever. And maybe we'll see Vader. There seems to be some talk about that. But I thought that was if I was going to sum up the worst thing about episodes one through three was that it was trying to fit into a box that it had to fit into. And seeing yet another movie added to the, well, it has to fit into this box canon, it bothers me. I think it's just the wrong thing to be doing. Like, I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I do. I agree. And I think it's dangerous to put a whole lot of stock in these side stories because, frankly, a lot of times they don't really prove to be all that interesting. I mean, it's now they've got to make the theft of the Death Star plans into a huge spectacle. And, you know, the reality is it really may not be all that interesting a story to tell. I think the trailer looks fantastic. I'm with you. I think the casting's great. It's great to see more different kinds of locations. You know, I don't think that episode seven was super successful in kind of world building, even though there were new worlds. I mean, Jakku was basically Tatooine.
Yeah.
Takodana, all we really saw was the Cantina, which could have been anywhere. Starkiller Base was just kind of, you know, kind of Hothy. It looks like there's some different kind of biomes that we see, and we see like the Empire's ground game with the walkers, and it looks like there's some actual like some new things that we'll get to see in this movie with some new types of characters. It's not all Jedi versus Sith. It's, and you know, stormtroopers. It's you know, kind of spies, and you know, the hopefully, my hope is, it's, you know, the rebellion kind of having to work with maybe people of less than sterling repute, you know, working with these kind of rogue people, if you will. And you know, my hope is that they'll actually kind of really dig into that.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm hopeful, but I'm nervous. And I can't say I'm super inspired by their choice in director. They picked Gareth Edwards,
yeah,
who was coming off Godzilla. And you know, I'm a big Godzilla fan, and I watched that film, and I didn't think it was very good at all. And it was just kind of a mess of a story that even halfway through, I'm like, what are we dealing with here? It's just, you know, where's Godzilla? What's the story here? It was a real kind of disaster of a film to me. And then to turn over and say, okay, you're in charge of the first, you know, non-primary Star Wars film in the overall master arc, that seems really risky to me, given his track record.
Well, and you know what could happen that's very similar between those two franchises is you've got, you know, Godzilla's a tough one to pull off, right? Because it has to be exciting, and it has to be kind of, you know, action packed. But you know, Godzilla is also, there's kind of a little bit of whimsy to the character that, you know, you've got to be able to have some fun with it. And Star Wars is kind of the same way. It's a big action movie, but it's pretty light too. It's never too heavy. Even when it's heavy, it's never oppressively heavy. It's, you know, there's no kind of, alien kind of feeling about these movies. They're always pretty kind of space fantasy. And if you try to take Star Wars down too serious a path, you very well may end up with a movie that doesn't feel like a Star Wars movie. And there's a real chance of that happening. Godzilla, I think, felt kind of not like a Godzilla movie. It just felt kind of like a, I don't know, it felt more like a Cloverfield style, or a, you know, kind of a more kind of grimdark action film. And I didn't think it worked either.
Yeah. Okay. Let's move on to the other trailer we're going to talk about, which is Star Trek Beyond. Obviously we have already established that both films are coming out this year, which you would have thought that's the first time both franchises released in the same year, but it actually is not. In 2002, we had Attack of the Clones and the aforementioned Nemesis, which was a franchise ender basically for a while,
which,
until the reboot.
Which is worse?
Ooh.
Question for another day, perhaps.
Yeah.
Anyway, I mean, please proceed.
I'm going to just quickly say Nemesis is worse, but not by a lot. Okay, so let's get a quick listen on the Star Trek Beyond trailer.
Everyone who goes there, he kills.
That's our friends out there. We kind of just leave them behind.
Unity is not your strength. It is a weakness.
I think you're underestimating humanity.
All right, Lee, so we talked about the director of Rogue One. Let's talk about the director of Star Trek Beyond. This time we draw Justin Lin, who has become sort of a Hollywood force because he directed now 4 Fast and Furious movies. And, you know, I think with the exception of Tokyo Drift, the other ones made pretty good money. And Tokyo Drift was a reboot of its own where they just weren't sure where to go with the story. So they completely took a risk and came in with new characters and just kind of traveled on the franchise brand, which was a film, actually, I have to admit, as a guilty pleasure, I find enjoyable. I, you know, the caveat being I actually like that franchise. It gets a little tired at times, but I've enjoyed those films. They're not great, but they're fun popcorn films.
Well, and I mean, to Justin Lin's credit, I mean, you take a franchise, what franchise has gone 5, 6, 7, 8 movies and like keeps getting more successful and more popular? I mean, that is not easy to pull off. I don't know that that has really ever been done, unless you're talking about like a Star Wars kind of series. I mean, but a typical action, I mean, think about the Die Hard movies, right? I mean, those really couldn't sustain themselves past maybe I know you like the 4th one, but you know, those have really fallen off, and I think that's what you typically see with these kinds of movies. But he has, you know, really tapped into something with this kind of this genre and this kind of energy he brings. And I mean, that will probably serve him very well with Star Trek Beyond.
Yeah, I mean, and it's, you know, again, he's working with that great cast, you know, Chris Pine, Zachary Quinto, Zoe Saldana, Simon Pegg, Carl Urban. You know, I'll throw a bone to Anton Yelchin, but he's got a pretty small role. Here's the thing that surprised me. I know I had heard before I watched the trailer that Idris Elba's in this, who's another actor I really love. Mm-hmm. He is so buried in that makeup. Like, yeah, it could literally be anybody.
Yeah, no, it's true. It's true. You know, I know he has complained about his role in Thor. He really doesn't enjoy playing Heimdall. I don't know if it's the contacts or if it's the fact that he gets so little to do or that he has to wear that goofy headgear. But it'll be interesting to see if he seems to enjoy this more, because, yeah, he is completely buried in that kind of reptilian makeup. I will have to say about this trailer, the first trailer for Star Trek Beyond really had me worried. The Beastie Boys Sabotage trailer,
yeah,
because I just thought that was a really cliched song to go to. I thought that the whole kind of the action sequences just really looked very, it looked like a Fast and the Furious movie in space, which is probably the premise for Fast and the Furious 10 whenever it comes out. You heard it here first. But the new trailer, I think, strikes a much better and a much more interesting tone. I mean, that it actually looks like a movie that I would happily sit through, whereas the first trailer I was kind of dreading.
Yeah, no, I think the second trailer definitely was a big improvement, and it has, you know, it has that Justin Lin stamp where, you know, Kirk's doing, like, I think it's Kirk presumably riding like a dirt bike and doing like a 60-foot jump wheelie or whatever he's doing there. That is like classic Justin Lin. And I know some people were kind of complaining about that, but the reality is they do establish in, you know, the JJ Star Trek, you know, he does ride a motorcycle, and there have been other, you know, like there's, I know there were some like off-road vehicle action, and maybe that was Nemesis, you know, where they're on that on that planet, and they're like dune bugging around.
The dune buggies, yep.
So clearly, like the Federation, you know, vehicle set has some advanced stuff, and it has some old school stuff in it too. So if he breaks, you know, the dirt bike out of like a shuttle or builds one out of spare parts, I'm going to be on board with that.
I mean, so you as a longtime Star Trek fan, I mean, I think that if I don't want to put words in Gene Roddenberry's mouth. I feel like if he saw this trailer, he would be like, what have you done? Like, this is not what I had in mind. Do you think that it's just, or I don't know if you agree with that or not, but do you think that Star Trek has just had to evolve to become, to have the currency that it needs to resonate with today's audiences? Or do you think they've kind of violated the spirit of the show?
Well, I mean, that's a tough question, because obviously Gene Roddenberry's vision for what humanity essentially evolves into, you know, they're in the original Star Trek, they're on a 5-year mission to explore. You know, they're in a military vessel, but they're exploring, and wherever possible, they're trying not to interfere. They're not trying to start up stuff with anything. You know, they get into a lot of trouble, obviously. So then you flash that to what they're doing now, you know, which is a more politically combative universe that they're setting it in now. I don't necessarily think he would have a problem with that. You know, he may not like some of the, at the end of Star Trek, they offer Eric Bana's ship is being swallowed up by the red matter black hole, and they offer him help, and you know, he refuses, and they're like, well, screw you.
<That's
right. laughs> Like, I don't think Gene Roddenberry probably would have appreciated that particular sentiment, although I enjoyed it myself as watching the way the movie was playing out. I don't know if he would be so offended. Frankly, if you created something and you saw it was still going, you know, from the, you know, 50 years later or whatever it's been now or will be eventually, I think you'd be nothing other than, you know, prideful about that and so happy that you did something that resonated so well that it lasted. So, you know, I think he'd probably be mixed. He'd probably be, frankly, more concerned with some of the other movies like, you know, the one where they go looking for God, and it turns out it's like Spock's brother. I mean, that's obviously the low point of that series.
Yes.
But I think he would have also appreciated, you know, the Cold War movie they did where it's, you know, the Klingons and the humans kind of come together and like find peace. And, you know, that movie's entertaining. It's not the best either, but I like that one. And I think he would have appreciated the spirit because, you know, some of those early episodes were definitely charged with the politics of their time.
Oh, yeah. I think Undiscovered Country is probably my favorite Star Trek movie, believe it or not. You know, it's funny you mentioned the scene where they, you know, the screw you scene. The thing that I think is kind of funny about that scene, and I don't know if this is intentional narratively or not, but in pursuing this doomed ship to blow it up before it could even fall into the black hole singularity thing, like, he pretty much almost kills his entire crew, right? Because he kind of follows him in to blow him up, and then they, you know, barely escape by what they do, eject the core, the warp core, or some ridiculousness. But I always thought that was kind of funny that, like, you know, his hubris does almost kill everyone, even though they don't really kind of address that in the context of the movie.
And I find that sort of acceptable, because that's, I think, one of the things that you can believe, or you can believe in the timeline they've set up, where he didn't grow up with a father, and perhaps he just wasn't, you know, he wasn't raised to be more respectful of other people and to keep himself in check. So seeing Kirk, and this has continued into darkness, you know, he's still kind of finding his way. He's still a bit immature. He still takes really bad risks. He still has too much ego, you know, which isn't exactly the Shatner Kirk version we saw. You know, he had an ego and he did some stuff, but he was more measured.
I don't want to say you're convincing me here, but there is something to be said for, you know, at the end of Into Darkness, where he sacrifices himself for his crew, maybe there is some kind of narrative arc there. I think that's maybe giving a little more credit than credits do, but I'll give you that one.
Okay. So bottom line, which one are you more excited to see?
I think there is a reasonable chance that the Star Trek movie could be a dud. I'm not 100% convinced. I'm a little annoyed. They're apparently trashing another Enterprise. Like, they really shouldn't do that every movie, because now you just kind of assume that the Enterprise is just going to be in ruins by the end. You know, that said, I've enjoyed the first two enough that I'll definitely see it. But for my money, I mean, Rogue One, I will be there on day one, because, you know, seeing the Death Star again and seeing the old school Star Destroyers, I think is just going to be more cool than I can possibly handle. How about you?
I think I'm with you. I probably am more excited about Rogue One, but it's definitely playing on seeing Imperial Walkers like kicking ass again and seeing the Death Star being badass again. That pushes it past Star Trek for me. But, you know, I'm optimistic that Star Trek Beyond will be entertaining. I hope it is, because I want that franchise to keep going and keep evolving. That's my hope.
No, I hope so too. And if they can keep the Enterprise from going underwater in this one, that would be a big win for Justin Lin, because that really bothered me in Into Darkness.
Yeah, I'm actually a little bit disappointed. In Into Darkness, we saw like a super starship, right, that they had developed using Khan's technology and his intellect. And shouldn't, you know, any reason to throw the plans away for that ship? Because that ship was awesome. It could actually, like, in warp attack you. It could get there faster. It had superior firepower, required a smaller crew. That really ought to be the ship they're rolling in on the five-year mission. You know, maybe it sets a bad tone to go out in, like, a hardcore warship, but to ignore the technological advancements that clearly Khan brought seems kind of stupid.
No, you're right. You're right. Well, now that they're going to wreck the Enterprise again, maybe they'll rebuild it with that technology in mind.
One can only hope.
Let's hope so.
All right. All right, Lee, I thought it would be fun for our final segment to do sort of a lightning round, Star Wars versus Star Trek, and we'll just keep rolling. I got a bunch of questions for you. Best movie of either franchise.
Ooh, best movie of either franchise. My favorite Trek movie is Undiscovered Country. My favorite Star Wars movie is The Empire Strikes Back. And given that The Empire Strikes Back is one of my probably top three movies of all time, I would have to go Empire Strikes Back.
Empire Strikes Back for you. I am going Wrath of Khan, which is just a movie I will love till the day I am dead. All right.
It's a great movie.
Okay, Lee, which movie is more absurd, The Phantom Menace or Star Trek's worse, which you can guess is?
The Final Frontier.
The Final Frontier.
So The Final Frontier is a singularly, like, awful movie. Like, that is one of the worst movies ever. The Phantom Menace is not a great movie. It's the most disappointing movie of all time, I think. I don't know that there's ever been a movie that's had such high expectation and has fallen quite as far from it. So I would have to say, I would have to give the absurdity winner to The Phantom Menace, because it should have been better. It should have been so much better.
Wow, I dare you to rewatch Final Frontier tonight. It's worse. It's much worse.
Oh, it's terrible. It's terrible. But it's, you know, it's a movie that I think had a very different kind of expectation. You know, I mean, episode one has come to symbolize like a hubris and a storytelling errancy that is pretty hard to ignore.
Okay. All right. Star Trek versus Star Wars. Which has the better names for its movies? Which franchise?
Better names. Wow. You know, they both have a couple of winners and some duds. I would say, though, The Phantom Menace is a horrible name. Attack of the Clones is an almost unforgivably bad title. And Revenge of the Sith was kind of a boring gimme. Probably Star Trek has better names.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, every title in the Star Wars prequel is just garbage. Just absolute, like, drivel.
One of the great just video clips from back in 2001 or 2002 was when the paparazzi, Ewan McGregor was on some kind of like red carpet, and they asked him, they had just announced the name and he hadn't heard yet. And I believe his response was something on the order of, "Are you fucking kidding me?" because he hadn't heard the title yet. And that's kind of how I feel too.
Okay. Moving on. Which franchise has the better music overall?
Oh, wow. You know, I mean, the John Williams Star Wars score is impossible to beat. It's the best score of all time of any movie. You know, Trek's got some great stuff. The James Horner stuff is terrific, but John Williams all the way.
Okay. I probably agree with you, and it's a little bit unfair because, you know, Williams has scored, I think, pretty much all the movies, and Star Trek had, you know, different people do it. You know, Michael Giacchino did the most recent films, and I actually really like his work. That one's tough. If I was pushed to a decision, I would say Star Wars probably wins just by a little bit. But I will say I wasn't super impressed with the soundtrack for Force Awakens. Like, there wasn't, you know, that one song that you got in each of the other movies that was like, oh, that song's awesome, and that's, like, that's new. Like, I kept listening to that movie waiting for, like, that breakout cool song for the, you know, whatever the big fight scene was going to be in this case. Maybe it was Kylo Ren versus Rey. I don't know. That was a missing component to me.
No, and you know, I love John Williams. I don't know that his recent work has had quite the power of his work in the 70s and 80s. But I'll tell you, the maybe 7 or 8 minute end credit music to The Empire Strikes Back, you know, where they kind of go through all the different themes and then it kind of has this big build up at the end. I mean, it gives me chills just thinking about it. It is such a great just kind of journey through the entirety of that movie through music. And it's like nothing else. It's so good. And I listen to it all the time just on my iPhone walking around. So it's one of my favorites.
Yeah, I think we're going to have to come back to this topic, movie soundtracks, sci-fi movie soundtracks. I like this topic a lot. Okay, keep this rolling, though. Which franchise has had the best TV shows?
Ooh.
And obviously we're talking animated to fill out the Star Wars side of the equation.
You know, and this is where I worry a little bit about Rogue One, in that I don't think any of the Star Wars TV shows have quite... I don't think they've quite worked as true partners to the films, you know, because the audiences are different. I would say that with Star Trek, I mean, the shows and the movies really do feel like much more of a piece. With Star Wars, it feels like, you know, here's something for younger kids in this universe that's also kind of canon, but we'll throw it out if we want to. So Star Trek for sure.
Yeah, that's a no brainer. Here's a fun one: best toys. And obviously, you've probably seen, you know, the newer toys more so than I have because you've got some kids. But I'm actually specifically referring to the toys that, say, you played with when you were a kid.
You know, the only I didn't have a lot of Star Trek toys. I did have an Enterprise that was maybe about, I don't know, a foot long. That was a pretty cool. It was a pretty cool ship. You could actually take the nacelles off, and you had a couple of little places you could attach them, little hard points like one on the saucer, and you could kind of make your own custom ship. That was pretty cool. But I mean, Star Wars, man. I mean, Star Wars toys were my jam growing up.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I actually did have some Star Trek toys, which I love dearly, but Star Wars, the merchandising around that was just amazing.
Unreal.
And when those little figurines started coming out, man, I would have, like, killed other small children to have a complete set of those.
Oh my God, for sure.
Okay, best video games. I think it's another easy one, but figured I'd throw it out there.
Well, you know, it's funny. I mean, they've both had a fair number of games and a fair number of winners, and it's a real duds, too. I really like there's a Star Trek 25th anniversary point-and-click game from back in the, I guess, the early 90s. That was actually pretty great. They brought the cast back for voice work. You can actually buy it now on GOG.com. I don't know how well it's held up, but it was pretty cool. And they had a next generation game that had the cast, and it was in the early days of CD video. They had some, you know, original video footage. But I mean, again, you know, when a Star Wars game is really working, man, there's nothing like it. The Jedi Knight games were amazing. You know, the Battlefront games have been really strong. And even like the 3D games that you and I used to play on the N64 and GameCube.
Oh, Rogue Squadron?
Rogue Squadron, yes. Yeah, those were really tight.
Those were great games.
Those were great games.
And even, I want to say Shadow of the Empire, I think was a Super NES game.
It was, yes.
I could be wrong, but I think that was the first game where you could actually take down a walker with a land speeder on Hoth.
I think you're right.
I think that's the origin of that, and being able to do that was like mind blowing.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And you know, and even before that, the Super Star Wars games were also, you know, go try playing one of those. Those were not easy.
Impossible. Yes, you're right. Side scrollers. Yeah.
Yeah. Those were no jokes. That era of gaming. Okay. Best books or comics.
You know, I have not really, I might have to kick this one back to you because I have not read a lot of Trek fiction. And honestly, I don't like a lot of the Star Wars fiction. The expanded universe stuff didn't do much for me. I read Heir to the Empire, which was, you know, really the first kind of big Star Wars novel of the post Return of the Jedi era. And I didn't really like it very much. It felt like a pale imitation for me. So I would probably say neither.
No, that's a fair enough answer. I mean, it's funny that you were going to throw it back to me. I was like, I wasn't really sure if I had a good answer to this question. I will say this. I would probably never in a million years read a Star Wars or Star Trek book. Like, I'm okay. I'm good with the movies. I would probably consider comic books, and there's quite a few of them that they've put out, you know, now the Disney Marvel is, you know, one massive empire. I bet the answer through those comics is ultimately going to be Star Wars, but I don't feel any desire to go find additional content from either of those two formats.
Yeah, I will say the one thing that was kind of interesting about reading The Force Awakens novel is that it was written based on an early draft of the script. And so there are a couple of scenes that are in the book that were clearly cut from the movie. I mentioned earlier the whole dark matter thing. That was clearly something they changed, you know, kind of in a later revision of the script. So it's kind of interesting in that respect, just seeing the evolution of the story, if you find that interesting. But as a book, it's actually pretty bad.
Yeah. Okay. Which universe would you want to live in if you could pick?
Oh, Trek. Trek all the way.
Yeah, I mean, Trek. 100% Trek, right? I mean,
Gene Roddenberry, like, absolutely created, like, a universe that feels genuinely utopian. Who wouldn't want to be on a bright spaceship with everything you've ever wanted, with no job except to be curious and to explore and to meet new races? But how amazing would that be?
Right. So I think you may have just answered this, but I was going to ask, would you rather work a low-end job on the Enterprise or on the Death Star? We're talking like janitor here.
Either way, you're probably going to get killed because neither one of them lasts very long. But yeah, man, the Enterprise all the way.
Okay. Which universe has the best aliens?
You know, you ask an interesting question because when you go back to like the motion picture, Star Trek, the motion picture, you see a lot more kind of aliens, just incidental aliens, like working in Starfleet and kind of hanging out. They don't seem to do that as much anymore. And when they do, they just don't ever engage with them. I don't know if it's, they're worried about the kind of the Jar Jar Binks effect of kind of a character that doesn't feel like a real character. You know, I think that Star Wars has been more successful at making non-human characters into characters you care about. I mean, you know, Yoda, you know, is a puppet, but sure as hell doesn't feel like one. And I don't think there's any, I don't think Star Trek has been as successful in doing that with true alien characters.
Agreed. Best villain?
Khan.
Wow, I'm shocked that you didn't go Vader.
Because, you know, Vader is, he's got kind of a, I mean, Khan's interesting for his humanity. You know, you get Khan, you know why he does what he does, and that makes him interesting. He's a very interesting villain. And, you know, he goes out like a badass, man. He goes out, you know, a true believer, and that's pretty awesome. How about
favorite,
you?
Favorite con? Oh, well, oh, sorry, I'll answer that. I'm kind of partial to Vader. He's got some problems, but at the end of the day, I guess I just kind of grew up watching him, and he was like badass sitting there with his cape and force choking punks. Like, that was cool. Like, Khan's a much better leader, a much better strategist, and he doesn't, like, assault his own people, but that doesn't make him more, like, evil to me.
You know what really gets me about Khan is this scene where they first, where Chekhov I don't remember the other guy's name. But Chekhov and the other
His captain.
From the Enterprise. Yeah. Where they meet him on the Botany Bay, and they've got this
kind Botany of, Bay?
Botany Bay.
Botany Bay.
Oh, no. And they've got this long kind of sequence where he kind of like, you're not really sure like what this guy's about. And then as this, you know, lengthy scene goes on, you realize like, oh my God, this guy is really, he's really pissed, and he's not crazy. He knows exactly what he's doing. And he's got a plan, and he's working the plan. And it's like, I think the menace in that scene is so, it kind of builds so gradually. You know, Darth Vader, he's like, you know, he's nothing. He, especially in the earlier movies, is he's nothing but evil. But he doesn't really kind of have that richness. I mean, Khan is a very rich villain, especially that given that he was only in one film.
Absolutely. Okay. Best robots? Seems like a pretty easy one.
Yeah, gotta go R2 and 3PO.
Which universe has better technology, in your opinion?
I would say Star Trek. I mean, you've got much more functional ships. Everything in Star Wars is dirty and seems old. You've got food synthesizers. You've got the Enterprise looks like a pretty bomb place to live,
a MacBook store.
Especially the Abrams verse, it does, yes.
Yeah, with lens flares on tap. But I think the technology is much better. The Millennium Falcon against the Enterprise, you would think that would be over pretty fast.
Although, you know, when Riker busts out the joystick, remember that one? When he, so it's not all good. But
I think don't they have something similar to getting back to Nemesis where like he rams Enterprise into the that Romulan supercruiser that Tom Hardy / Bane is driving. Isn't there some awful conclusion along those lines?
There is. I think Data jumps across or something. That's awful. That's awful.
Okay. Fist fight. Who would win between Greedo and the Gorn? Or a Gorn, a member of the Gorn race?
Well, the guy in the Gorn suit doesn't seem to be able to see. So,
can Greedo see though? Come on now.
So Greedo, is Greedo allowed to shoot? If Greedo's allowed to shoot, then no. I think he might win. If the premise was
fist fight.
If it's fist fight, I guess I've got to go Gorn. He's got some shoulders behind him, and Greedo seems a bit slight.
Okay. How about Gorn versus Chewbacca? Level the playing field.
Dude, let the Wookiee win, man. He'd pull the Gorn's arms off.
All right, Kirk versus Han Solo.
Ooh,
fist fight.
This is getting tough. I gotta go Kirk. Han, we never really see him except that one punch he gives Lando. We never really see him in a fist fight, and Kirk has him all the time.
100% Kirk. I mean, the guy's constantly getting into fist fights.
Yes, yeah.
And he knows how to get his shirt torn, and he knows how to take a punch and get a little bloody. Absolutely, Kirk.
All the way.
Okay. Who's a better tactician, Admiral Akbar or Admiral Kirk? And when I'm saying Admiral Kirk, I'm talking Wrath of Khan Kirk.
Tactician.
And the premise here is I think they're both pretty awful. So maybe the question is who's a worse tactician?
Well, I mean, yeah, it's I'm thinking, the Enterprise gets pretty much roasted by Khan.
Yep.
Akbar... He emerges victorious. They take down a Super Star Destroyer. That's something.
But he does lead the entire rebellion into a trap.
It's a trap.
Okay, I'll give you Akbar, but only because of outcome, for which he has very little to do. Okay. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I was really happy to see Admiral Ackbar again in episode 7. I hope he is a recurring character.
It was a little bit forced. Like, again, having just recently watched that, it was like kind of unclear who was leading that like crew of folks. You know, there's a lot of voices in that thing. And then Dameron Poe's like, well, we just got to attack. It's like, dude, you're established as like the best pilot, but you're making the decisions now.
Yeah, no, it's not a very well-run shop, apparently.
Okay. Best spaceship.
Of all of them? Or?
Of all of them. And I'm not saying which one would win in a fight. I'm just saying, like, what do you think the best ship is? Is it, or maybe best is wrong. Well, what's the coolest ship?
You know, it's kind of funny. I have always been really partial to the Episode 5 Star Destroyers. And I think it's because, looking back, like, that was when I really kind of got into, like, how movies were made. And it was, like, watching a lot of, like, you know, they used to have the specials on HBO or whatever, and they would have the books that would come out. And the models that they used for the Star Destroyers in Episode 5 were so beautiful and so intricately detailed. I used to just sit and just stare at them because they were so cool. And, like, I could really imagine that, like, those lights were actually windows. And it was just such a convincing ship. And, you know, you've got the whole scene at the beginning of Episode 4 where it flies overhead. And you've just, so for me, it's the Star Destroyer.
I always was a big fan of the Star Destroyers. I love the Executioner that we got to see in Jedi. I wish I had bought one of the Lego sets for that before they basically turned into stick 'em up prices online. However, I have to answer the Enterprise. That was like the first like seriously awesome spaceship I saw when I was a kid, and I just really locked onto it. And so it pisses me off that basically every movie they're destroying it.
So do you have a particular revision of Enterprise, or just Enterprise with the dish on the front?
I like the dish on the front. I mean, you got to get DirecTV in space. You need a dish out front.
Fair enough.
Okay, what is more ridiculous? Metachlorians or Khan's Lazarus blood from Into Darkness?
Oh, God. that's kind of a push, dude. So here's my thing. I actually don't hate midichlorians as a concept, because we've established in the Star Wars universe that there is a genetic aspect to the Force. And so the fact that they have a way to measure the degree to which you are Force sensitive, it kind of makes a certain sense. That actually doesn't bother me all that much. I think the blood problem, the problem with the blood in Star Trek Into Darkness, is I can't figure out if they have kind of cured people from death. I don't really know what the implications of that are. And if I know J.J. Abrams, and I know J.J. Abrams, they're just never going to mention it again. But the fact that it just kind of was this deus ex machina that brought Kirk back from being dead seems a bit tidy for me. So I would say, I give midichlorians a pass, and I would go blood.
I hate them equally both. I think the blood thing was just such a real lame cheat, you know, to just reverse it and kill Kirk instead of Spock, but bring him back. I mean, the reason I don't like it as a cheat is, at the end of the day, that's like transporting across the galaxy. The revolution that would have to come from that. I mean, they've got like 70 plus people who have apparently, you know, resurrection blood. That would change the face of the universe.
Totally.
And like, if that's not what the rest of the series is about, then they've missed that note.
Yeah, and it won't be. And they will miss that note. You're absolutely right.
Absolutely. And then of course, Metachlorians, my God. That's probably, to me, like, we started off talking about which you like more, Star Wars or Star Trek. Fundamentally, I believe in science, and Star Trek adheres more to that. Star Wars ultimately gets boiled down to midichlorians and Force, and it's a little bit too religion-y for me. And so in the battle of religion versus science, I'm always going to identify more on the science side of things.
Well, I think what I liked about, I mean, I can't believe I'm saying this sentence, but what I liked about the midichlorians was that you know, it took this thing that was kind of mystical in nature. And, you know, one of the criticisms of the Jedi you can have in the original, or in the prequels rather, is that they're emotionless, and their unwillingness to be, like, for want of a better word, human, is kind of what brings them down. And I don't know that Lucas intended this, but I do kind of like this notion that they took this thing, which was kind of spiritual, and it's in all of us. And, you know, Yoda's whole thing, you know, it's binds us all together, and it's in the rock, and they kind of turned it into like a thing that you can measure in someone's blood. I'd like to think that that was kind of, you know, symbolic of the fact that the Jedi had kind of lost track of what made them special, and had kind of turned it into this, like, you know, blood test. But I think that's probably giving too much credit.
Okay, along similar lines, what's a better saying to you? Live long and prosper, or may the Force be with you?
I would say if I had to have something said to me, like, before I was going under for, say, major surgery, I would take live long and prosper.
Yeah, no doubt. All right, we're going to bang through these last couple.
Okay.
More absurd, Tribbles or Ewoks?
Tribbles.
Tribbles. 100%. However, I do hate Ewoks with a passion. I mean, obviously those were supposed to be Wookiees, and they eventually got around to showing us the Wookiee homeworld, and that was exciting. But my God, Ewoks. I find those portions of Jedi unwatchable.
Yeah, I love the Tribbles. They're fun. But in terms of, like, absurdity, they're ridiculous. I mean, you know, they were clearly just a cheap effect that they could pull off, you know, with some string and hairballs, stuffed critters. But yeah, I would rather have seen Wookiees and Ewoks.
Okay. Romulan ale, or whatever drink you can get in a Mos Eisley bar.
Blue milk. I would take a Romulan ale here on a Friday night. Absolutely.
I'm definitely down for the Romulan ale. It's probably not as good as the Zima, but I'm sure it's pretty close.
Just make sure you keep some Advil and Gatorade close by, because I understand it packs a punch.
That's right. Okay, these last two questions I have for you are somewhat Father's Day inspired. They are, what school would you rather send your kids to, the Vulcan K-12 or the Jedi Academy? And I'm talking Jedi Academy on Coruscant. And let's just pretend you don't know that things are going to turn
everybody
out poorly.
Gets murdered. Where would I send my youngling? I would have to go Jedi Academy. Yoda seems like a nicer teacher, and the little Vulcans seem like a bunch of punks.
They are a bunch of punks, but they clearly know how to educate their kids.
Yeah, they put them in like some kind of education pit with like a robot, a machine that interrogates them all day. That seems kind of cruel.
But that's the future of education. Let me put it to you this way. Those kids are going to do a lot better than Earth kids when they get to Starfleet Academy, because they just get a better education. I mean, basically, the only reason the only reason Kirk ends up captain is because he's just kind of like a baller. Spock should have been captain.
Absolutely. Absolutely agreed. But if I had to pick a school, I'd go Jedi.
Okay. And our final question.
Okay.
Who's a worse father? Kirk? Or Han Solo?
Well, let's see. They're both pretty awful.
They're terrible. Terrible.
But Kirk gets his son stabbed, and Han gets killed by his son. They're both absentee. Yep. Wow, this is a great question for Father's Day. I guess... If I had to put myself in a position where I had to choose one of them for a father, Han Solo seems like he would be a little more fun. Kirk seems like he could be kind of a pill.
Okay. I will let that one ride. There's no good answer to that question, but you made an honest attempt.
I did. I do my best.
All right, that's our show. I'm Adam Levine, and as always, joining me is Lee Klontz.
All right, Adam, that was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Yeah, and it was great. We got our geek on and got to dig into one of our favorite head-to-head topics. And we will be back soon with episode 3. Follow us on Twitter at Zod Podcast, and subscribe and follow our actual podcast on SoundCloud, iTunes, and Google Play. Lee, it's been great.
Been a pleasure. Take care.
All right, thanks.